everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, May 28th, 2018. It's Memorial Day, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. Thank you guys for joining me today, or any day thereafter, because this is, of course, a podcast, and you don't have to listen to it on the day it goes live. Sometimes it goes live right before midnight anyway, so I'm not sure how you can listen to it on the day it goes live. But that is my schedule being out of control. This week it was not. This week I was so thrilled to be able to chat with a really great guest. I cannot believe I waited this long to do so. But before we dive into that, I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible, including those of you who support the show via Patreon. If you want to become a patron of the show, you just go to patreon.com. That's patreon.com/talknerdy. This week, the top patrons are Rob Schreck, Phil T-Bear, The Zombie Drummer, David J.E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jonathan Wright, The Honorable Husband, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Hermil Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. And this week, I finally chat with the one and only George Hrab. So if you guys listen to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, you already know who George is. If you guys are big in the skeptic community, the atheist community, the critical thinking community, you already know who George is. If you know about his awesome band called the Philadelphia Funk Authority, where he plays all over the country, but I think they're located where he's from in Pennsylvania, then you already know who he is. And of course, if you already listen to his podcast, the Geologic Podcast, then he needs no introduction, although I think I might have just given him one. I know George through the skeptic circuit. He is always the best MC. He hosts a lot of these conventions. He's incredibly funny. He's incredibly kind-hearted. And of course, he is the most dapper dresser I know. So without any further ado, here he is, George Hrab. Well, George, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. And let me start by saying, number one, like, congrats to you for jumping into the SGU swamp with both feet from the beginning. You know, it's not the easiest crew to get in good with, like not because of them or anything, but you're literally dealing with three brothers and two guys that have known each other for 20 years. And you have done so wonderfully well. I just want to congratulate you, like, officially, so others can know what a difficult job it is. Aww. And how awesome you've done. And so, and everyone that I talk to is just like, can you believe how great Kara has fit in with these loonies? That's so sweet. Universally, the comments that I get from people that count and that don't count is just that you've done a wonderful job. So, number one, congratulations on doing that. And it was a seamless, it's like you'd been doing it forever. And that's really, really impressive and really, really cool. So, yay.
Thank you so much. That's so nice to hear. I have to say, it was super easy for me. Like, it was not a difficult transition by any stretch. The one thing that I will comment on with what you just said, which was so very kind, is that there are definitely times when Evan and I have side chats while we're recording, where we're like, oh, yes. Brothers.
Can you believe these Italian brothers? Should we leave? I totally get it. Yeah.
It's usually fine, but there are definitely times when they are at each other's throats to the point where you're like, wow, I should not comment here. Usually I just giggle in this really high-pitched way.
Yeah, I've been in the car with them when that happens sometimes, and it's just like, you can let me out here. This is totally fine. I'll walk the next 100 miles. You know, But then within an instant, they're the sweetest, loving guys again. And it's just like that relationship is so tight with them that it's fascinating to watch from kind of the inside. But
for sure,
you've done from the reveal at TAM, whatever the heck that was, to that very first long, like 2-hour show that we did where I just asked everybody the most sort of personal questions possible. Jay cried and it was great. It was just great. You grabbed on with both hands and you just surfed, and it's been awesome to watch and listen to. So, yay.
Oh, thank you so much.
Now we can talk about me.
Yes. Now let's spend the next hour talking about you.
Oh, no. Yeah.
I'm so excited that I can't believe I'm just now finally having you on the show.
Yeah, well, you know, people are doing stuff and there's
things. People are doing stuff.
Whatever.
Yeah, people are busy. There's all that.
It's all good.
You have, oh my gosh, do you have 562 episodes of your podcast?
I do. Isn't that ridiculous?
Whoa, wait. So how long is it weekly?
It's weekly. It's every Wednesday or Thursday I record it, and then every Thursday or Friday we upload it. So,
and then how long does... Okay, so I'm on episode 20. You're going to be episode like 206. Don't quote me on that. So, and that's 4 years. So if you're... what is that, like 9, 10 years?
It's actually 11. We had our 10th anniversary last February. We did a 10-hour live show in the Novella's basement. We did a 10-hour show, which was so much fun. So yeah, this February was 11 years.
Holy hell.
It's nuts. I can't believe it. I can't, you know, and it's so second nature now that just like if I don't ever not do a show, but if even it crosses my mind to not do a show, I would sooner like, you know, not bathe or something. It's just so a part of what my life is. It's just
so tell me about it, because this is not your main gig, right? You're a musician and you do a lot of kind of like hosting, emceeing. Like, I think ever since you really found yourself in the skeptic community, people just love you because you're so funny and you're so like comfortable on stage that you're the go-to guy. So let's talk before we dive into the podcast, because I really do want to focus on that. Also, let's back up a minute. Like, what is it, George Hrab, that you do for a living?
Well, officially, you know, the day job, quote unquote, is playing drums in a band called the Philadelphia Funk Authority. That's a band who, it's another one of these crazy things. We're having our 20th anniversary this year.
Wow.
I also can't.
Wait, how old are you?
I know, crazy. I'm 162 years old. You start these things really early and I just never leave. Now, as an example, my dad is a high school science teacher and he's been at the high school he's been at for 50 years.
Your dad is like never. My mom is retired. I know that I'm a little younger than you, but my mom is 70 and she just retired this past year. How the freak old is your father?
Well, he's 74, so he's not, you know, but he jumped in.
He just doesn't want to leave. Whatever.
He just doesn't want to leave, you know, and it's like, I get it, but it's this thing of like when the Hrab men start doing something, they just do it forever. They just like once they're in, like they're in. So yeah, a band, 20 years, a podcast, 11 years. I've been living in my apartment, my condo for 26 years. Like once we're in, we get very comfortable very quick. And then we don't want things to change ever, which can be detrimental, but whatever.
And so are you a Connecticutian as well?
No, I'm in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
You're in Pennsylvania. And are you born and raised? Are you a Pennsylvanian through and through?
Jersey boy. Northern New Jersey. Yeah. Northern New Jersey.
West Orange. So wait, you don't have, that's Southern New Jersey where they have the crazy accents.
Yeah, they have
that's
a little bit
very
of that
like
sort
Baltimore
of
almost.
Yeah, Baltimore Philly thing. Yeah, no, I had a little bit of a Jersey thing, like this kind of like for a little while. I sort of had this. I find old recordings of myself, and I kind of cut some of the a little bit of this, just a little bit, and it kind of like went away. I think as I got away from Jersey, so.
Yeah, my boyfriend, he was, I think he's from, I always forget. And then people are going to think that I'm a bad girlfriend.
Right.
He is from a part of New Jersey that. I can't tell you where, but he said when he was a little kid, he would say things like walk the dog.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Water. Yeah.
Water. Yeah. He said water.
Water.
And he had to like teach himself not to.
Yesterday was a thing. I have recordings of me myself saying yesterday, which is like, whoa, what is that about? Yeah.
That's insane. So you said in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, how far is that from Philly? I just know Philly. That's the only Pennsylvania I've been to.
It's like an hour from Philly. If you take New York City and Philadelphia and you draw an equilateral triangle, like that third point is where Bethlehem is. So it's really nice for me. I can get to New York in about an hour 20. I can be in Philly in about an hour 10.
Nice. And how long to hang out with the guys in Steve's basement?
That's like three.
Studio?
That's like just
that's
three.
Far.
A little bit more. But it's, you know, as a musician, like what I do is just drive my car. Like that's what I do. So it's
like 90% driving, 10% playing.
Seriously. I mean, it's just, that's the deal. Like, you know, for an hour gig, you will do 6 hours of driving there and back. And so whenever we have these events with the guys, it's always like, do you want to stay over? I'm like, no, it's 9 o'clock. I'm fine. I can drive home. I'll be home for midnight. That's easy. Yeah. That's cake. You kidding? Leaving the gig at 1 a.m. and getting home at 4, that's a little more challenging, but I can do that too. So,
yeah, I'm sure as we get up there in age, it's a little bit harder to stay up till like 5 in the morning every day.
Right.
I used to do that a lot too. But being a musician, somebody who's traveling quite a bit, do you have a dog at home? Is there anything like needing you to feed it and let it out? That's
I literally good. Have a DVD of fish. That I put on when I leave the house, I put in my bedroom, I put on the fish DVD so that when I come home, I just have this like moment of just like, oh, bubbles.
I like that.
Yeah.
It's like those fireplace DVDs.
Exactly.
It's weird that you have a DVD player still.
Well, it's like it's a dedicated TV that is in the bedroom, not connected to the cable or anything. It's solely for that. It's just it has a player in the side of it. So I bought this thing just to have. I actually bought it because I host Thanksgiving. So the whole family comes over. And I thought the first time I did that, let me get like a dedicated DVD TV player for all the kids. So they can go upstairs and they can watch Aladdin or whatever.
Oh, smart. Yeah, yeah.
And then it just became like, oh, now this is my aquarium. So
that's so smart. I love that.
Yeah,
man. Cool. Now I want to get one of those.
There you go. They're and so cheap. They're so cheap now. Oh my gosh. Forget about
it. And you can have all sorts of tropical fish and not feel at all guilty about the aquarium trade because it's just a video.
Exactly. Yeah. There's like seven different settings and it just cycles through. So I never know who I'm going to come home to, you know, if it's the clownfish or if it's the goldfish. And it's just, yeah, it's great. It's great.
I love it. I love it. My dog is sitting here at my feet right now while we're recording, giving me like total side eye.
What kind of dog is it?
So Killer, you know, people ask about Killer a lot. I'm glad you asked that because I never talk about him on the show except when he's barking. I'm like, shut up, Killer. That's the extent that people get. It's so weird. I got a DNA test recently and he's not at all what you would think he is. He looks like a Chihuahua Dachshund Spaniel.
Oh.
Like if I had to tell you, he looks exact because he's like long and he has the like weird little bow legs, but he's got the cute face with the long snout. He's about 10 pounds and he's adorable. But I got his DNA test and it turns out that he has no Dachshund in him at all, which is strange.
Wow.
He has no Spaniel. He is a Chihuahua Lhasa Apso mini poodle.
Whoa, dig it.
Okay. I know, it's like not at all what I signed up for, but okay. And it turns out that he doesn't look anything like his breed because he's a bit inbred.
Oh, all right.
Mom and dad's DNA was a bit similar.
Okay, so, okay, it's fine.
He's
it's
my
fine.
Recessive puppy. There and my go. Puppy, I mean, he's 8 years old. He's getting up there in age, but he looks
They're always puppies. They're always puppies. I had a boxer for years and he was eight and 110, 15 pounds, whatever. Yeah. Puppy. Total puppy. Yeah.
Oh, I love boxers. Did he do the wiggle dance?
Oh, forget about it. The happy dance, the wiggles. Yeah. Yeah. It's just, he was the best. He was the best.
Oh, boxers are the best. Oh, that's so good to hear. What was his name?
Oscar was his name, actually.
Oscar is a great name for a dog.
Yeah, one of the most sort of poignant and popular songs I've written, actually, is about losing him and like how not having faith to kind of rely on, having this idea of an afterlife to sort of like picture him in, and how I dealt with that. And it's amazing whenever I play that song, especially at the conventions and stuff that are usually like-minded people, you know, skeptics and critical thinkers and stuff, who for the most part, some do, but for the most part, people don't usually have an idea of heaven or things like that.
Yeah.
And it connects and, you know, I have my stupid songs about whatever, but that one sort of like just, it really resonates with people. And it surprised me how common a topic that sometimes is this like dealing with grief and loss as someone who doesn't believe in an afterlife. And like, how do we approach it? And so I wrote this song about him and it's been this wonderful and awful connection that I have with people. Cause invariably someone after a performance come up and be like, my cat just died or my dog just died or like a year ago or 5 years ago, whatever. And I get what you're saying. And it's been this lovely way. I mean, a horrible way, but a lovely way to sort of connect with people and commiserate. Mm. Sort of say, yeah. So that's like, I like that that's his legacy. He's sort of reached through me. Through my tunes that I write and has consoled just a few people. So it's kind of nice.
Oh my gosh. He's an eternal therapy dog.
Totally.
It's amazing. Yes. I love that.
Yeah.
So you mentioned your songs because I mean, we started to talk about it, but you played drums.
Yes.
For the Philadelphia Funk Authority.
That's right.
But you also, you're not just a drummer. You're a songwriter. You're a singer. You can play guitar. You own it. On stage. So this is the kind of stuff that you do as kind of your side music gig, would you call it that?
Because the band basically works like, let's say, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, the rest of the week traditionally was open. And that just allowed me to do other projects. So that off time, you know, before the show and even once the podcast was happening, just allows me to write songs. So I have seven albums that I've done. Oh, since whatever, 1997 was the first one.
Wow.
Going way back. And it was like, you know, I've got time to do stuff. So I'm going to just make stuff. And my best friend happens to own a studio in Queens up in New York. So that's nice. So he's been incredibly generous and he's like my engineer and kind of co-producer on all these things. So I just started writing these tunes and, you know, never thinking that, oh, I'm going to be this science skeptic, you know, guy, this like this MC guy who's going to somehow sneak in with his music, just writing about stuff that I found interesting and just sort of had a little bit of a different take on maybe. And then the community like found me. It was really cool. It was really cool.
I love that. That's so great. And so you've got sort of these three, or I would say like four, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, main points that you spend most of your at least vocational time doing. You're playing drums, you're doing your solo work, you are emceeing, hosting, doing a lot of stuff on stage that obviously incorporates your solo work, and then you're podcasting.
Yeah. That's about it.
Cool.
Yeah.
And would you say that it's about a quarter, a quarter, a quarter, a quarter? Like how would you say that you generally split your time?
Oh my gosh, it's a good question. It's probably in terms of actual time, probably like 30 to 40% of the band, because that's like, you know,
so that's your main gig.
That's the main gig, and that's usually the most lucrative in terms of the money production. Like I would say 2 days a week are spent on the podcast. And then, you know, the other stuff is sort of a little bit more incidental in terms of when those events happen, but those might be, you know, 4 or 5 times a year as opposed to weekly or monthly or whatever. So
gotcha.
Yeah, it's sort of quarter, but ish, you know, if a TAM or a Nexus or a QED is happening, then that is like everything that sort of takes over for that week or two where I'm prepping and traveling and whatever.
Oh, look at you. You prep. That's such a breath of fresh air. I don't really do that all that much anymore.
Well, you know, it's like, I think I learned early on kind of like you know, you put the work in ahead of time and it's still sort of levels of sheer terror, you know, beforehand and right up until I sort of walk on stage and then, but I rely on sort of putting in the work beforehand to know that, okay, if something goes wrong or something goes right or something goes different, like I'll be okay and prepared because I have thought of contingencies or whatever. And so, yeah, it's a little bit of prep. And, you know, if you're doing a 12-minute musical based on the life of James Randi, like,
yeah, you got to
write
that.
That's a certain amount of work. Ahead of time.
But, maybe rehearse it once or twice.
Yeah, I think we even talked about it. Like for me, the hardest thing is the idea. Like the hardest thing. Like I don't mind putting in hours and hours of work. The toughest thing is like, okay, I've got a 15-minute slot at this conference for the opening thing. Like what am I going to do? Like I have no idea. And I'm terrified. And then I think of this and that won't work. How about this? How about this? Ooh, how about a musical? Okay, a musical. What about a musical about James Rand? Oh, perfect. Okay. And then it's like, all right, now I'm done. The rest is just work. But like, that's the easy part, you know, like actually writing the thing and what the hardest bit for me has always been the creation, the idea behind the bit. You know, that happens.
Do you
with
have a process too. For that? Do it's you like, just,
no.
Do you like just sit down and like, you know, eat some mushrooms and see what comes to you?
Yeah, no, I wish there was a process because then I would do that because invariably it's like the ideas just sort of come from somewhere. And it may be when I'm out running, it may be when I'm driving in the car and about to fall asleep and ride off the road. It may be when I'm watching something else on TV. It may be when I'm making pasta, you know, like there's never a consistent thing of like, oh, if I do A, B, and C, I will get the idea. It's never like that. It's always like, okay, here's an idea. Crap. Here's an idea. Crap. Here's an idea. Crap. Here's an idea. Crap. A little less crappy. What if we do this? And then I'll call somebody and say, I have this like kind of crappy idea. And maybe they'll suggest another thing or, you know, and then you get that third idea, which is always better than the first one or the second one. Yeah. Like, you know, my stock line is, and people always say like, you know, where do you get your ideas? And I always say, if I knew where I got my ideas, I wouldn't be talking to you. I would be, I would be getting my ideas because I have no idea where they come from. It's so random.
And of course, you have to get ideas for all of these different outlets, which is something that I really respect about you. And I kind of feel like I can commiserate at like the teensiest, tiniest level in that. Being kind of a jack of all trades, you are not a master of none, which is good. You actually are a master of some, which is nice. But having in some ways struggling with the idea that you are spread a little bit thin can be at times fulfilling and at times really frustrating, can't it?
Yeah. I what I enjoy is that weird dichotomy or the weird thing that the anti-intuitive idea that like the busier you are, the more you do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if I have swaths of free time, like nothing gets accomplished.
Mm-hmm. Like you would think, that's like, when I watch Netflix.
Exactly. You know, like, oh, I have the whole weekend to do all these things and you do none of it. Whereas if I know, okay, crap, I have an hour on Tuesday, I got to get this logo done, or I got to write this sketch, or I got to get this, you know, podcast idea, or I have to learn this song for this wedding that we're doing. And that's the time I have to do it because everything else is whatever it may be. You just get so much more done. So I think there's that. And then I think there's also the sort of like attention span thing of just like, I like to just keep changing stuff and utilizing it's funny that the kind of different parts of your brain that cross over, you know, that you have to like, okay, we're writing lyrics for a song, so we're going to be try to be clever, which is like a humor thing, which is a humor thing I would use if I was writing a sketch like for Bill Nye or something, you know, like, okay, that's a humor. Then that has science stuff, which then I'm going to bring into the podcast to talk about this cool science idea, which then is going to relate to when I'm going to be on the SGU. We're going to be talking about nanotechnology with Bob and what, you know, so it's all this kind of chain of events that all feeds itself. And there is a theme running through everything, but it's kind of fun to have it be utilizing different aspects of whatever theatricality. Like I love, you know, doing interviews at conferences or whatever, running the thing and just like empathy, you know, like making sure people are comfortable. I love at a conference when you see someone who's obviously at their first, you know, whatever critical thinking conference and they're sort of shy and they're maybe embarrassed or they don't know what to do, and to make them feel comfortable, to be like, I am your host, you know, like, hey, you're on an elevator or something and they kind of get nervous or whatever. And not that I'm a celebrity or anything like that, but just people tend to be, you know, if they're,
yeah, you're the guy who's on stage.
Yeah. But even like in the environment of like, God, I don't know anybody and there's 1200 skeptics here. And like, what do I do? I love just being like, no, it's all good. Come on. Let's just hang. Let's just like make people feel comfortable, you know, like do the hosting thing in the same way that, like I said, when I host Thanksgiving, I love to do that because it's like, I'm going to make your experience like what I would want, you know, if I was going to be a guest in someone's house. And I'm going to do the same thing, hopefully with the podcast, hopefully, you know, when I'm on your show or on whoever's show, that like, I want to provide you with the thing that I would want. And it's a fun challenge and it's a fun way to think about sort of, you know, approaching problems and approaching problem solving and stuff. So yeah, it's very rewarding. It's very rewarding. And the best is that it's been completely unexpected. I mean, all of it. Oh my gosh. This was never the plan on any level. I mean, going back to the start of the podcast, it was like, let me do this for a year. Maybe I'll do like 50 shows and my engineering friend will tune in because he's the one who suggests that I do a podcast. My dad will tune in probably like maybe one out of three he'll listen to.
Oh gosh, I hope my dad doesn't listen to my podcast.
And that was it, you know, and then like all of a sudden, like people started sort of listening. And then I went to a conference and like the very first time someone like knew me that I wasn't related to, or I didn't go to college with, or that I didn't owe money to, it freaked me out. You know, it like, I remember it distinctly. I was in Baltimore. It was at Balticon, which is one of these things. And I walked.
What is that?
Balticon. Yeah. It's been going on for like 10 or 15 years.
Is it a skeptic conference?
No, it's like more a sci-fi kind of fantasy convention. So this was friends that suggested, yeah, I should come down. We do this thing. And I was like, okay. So I went down and I walked into a performance that was happening and someone turned around and was just like, are you George Robb? And like, they weren't my cousin. And it was like, and I remember the first thought that popped in my head, because it was this rush of adrenaline of like being recognized, which whatever that says about my ego or whatever, fine. But the first, literally the first thing that popped in my head was like, how does Sting ever like do anything? Like how does, you know, like someone that's world famous that can be recognized anywhere, you know, whether it's Elton John or, you know, President Obama or like how does that person remotely remain like human?
Yeah, like not ego. Well, the sad thing is that for a lot of them, I think that it gets like they get annoyed.
Oh, like absolutely.
It crosses over from being like, oh my God, this is the coolest thing that's ever happened to
absolutely,
me.
Absolutely. Yeah.
To I think being like, ugh, again.
Of course. You know? Of course. Yeah. But I think that initial sort of feeling of like, you know what they say, like the every subsequent high is just trying to recreate your first high, you know? Mm-hmm. So no wonder these people are full of themselves and no wonder they start experimenting with all kinds of who knows what chemistry to sort of enhance their experience to relive that moment of just, are you, hey, aren't you blah? Cause like, I've never felt that to that same extent as I did the first time a complete stranger in like three states away said, hey, aren't you blah? And it was like, whoa.
Yeah. You know, it was a crazy experience.
Yeah, yeah.
It is funky. It's especially with podcasting too, because like I've had, you know, it doesn't happen much, but I've had it where somebody has recognized me from a TV show I did or from whatever, but it's only happened a couple times where they didn't have any visual recognition of me, but the minute that I started talking, they were like, oh my God, you're Kara Sandra Marie. I recognized your voice.
That's cool. That's cool.
That's weird, right?
At Nexus 1 year, my mom and dad came to, I guess we were doing extravaganza and they were outside. And my mom is on the show, on the podcast every now and then. She does a bit. It's called Gio's Mom Reads Jay-Z Lyrics. She calls in and she just reads. She reads Jay-Z lyrics. I put beats behind it for like a minute, not even. And then we just chat. We just, cause they're always traveling all over the world. And we just have, you know, we have a BS session. It's great.
Nice.
So they're in line waiting to walk into the theater. And my mom is talking to my dad and the person in front of them turns around and says, are you Gio's mom? Recognized your voice. And she just like a rocket, just like, you know, NASA strapped to her butt. She was just took off and she felt so excited. You know, she would never admit this, but she was so excited. She was so just like, oh my gosh. And to me, it was like the best thing ever to have mom be recognized by someone. So yeah, it's neat. It's
so
neat.
Great.
You know, it shows you that people are paying attention, man. Like,
yeah. Oh, and it, you know, it's funny because you were mentioning before about how when you are emceeing at a conference or you're, you know, several times you have sort of guest hosted the SGU where we've taken a different format and then you interview us. We kind of flip the script and we don't do the standard science stories. And you're so good at it. You have, like you were just saying, because I mean, even the words you were using, exercising empathy, being able to really understand and make somebody feel quite comfortable. It's a real skill of yours. And it makes me wonder, why is it that you have chosen not to implement that into the podcast? Is it for kind of ease of not having to book people? Is it just because early on you set the format and like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it?
On some level, it's that. I have talked about having a major shift in the show. I think like probably 2 years ago was the first time I kind of said, like, I have this idea because I so enjoy it. I so enjoy doing that thing of chatting and being curious and just revealing maybe something unknown about someone. It's all of it. It's, yeah, there is a certain scheduling ease that I know, like I can get in the room and 4 hours later, like I'll be done. And there we go. And it's just, I have to worry about
and you
whatever.
Don't have to rely on anyone else.
Yeah. There's the tech thing too, which like for a while I was kind of like, oh, would I Skype this? Would I do the what? Would I do? And again, it's that weird kind of combination of laziness and just like, it's been working. So I'm just kind of just keep doing what I'm doing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But, like, I feel you. I want to dabble too. Like I've had these ideas. I actually recorded a bunch of audio when I was in the Amazon rainforest a few weeks ago. Oh, and I've been, I really want to put together some more like quote unquote Radiolab style, like more produced pieces. Then you sit back and I'm going to do it like one day, but you do sit back and go, oh yeah, they have a staff.
Yeah, totally. I know. I know. I forget that sometimes. It's just like, you know, I'm sitting here like, you know, racking my brain. Like, what can I talk about this week? And yeah, like there's a part of me just going like, you suck. Come on. Like, let's go. People are doing shows all the time. What's the matter? And then there's another little part of me that's just like, you've been doing this for 11 years and it's only, it's only you. Like you're allowed to take a, you know, take a breather for a minute and figure out what you're going to talk about. But I don't know. I love the therapeutic kind of quality of it. I mean, there was a time a couple of years back that being able to kind of vent on the show, like really saved my life, I think.
Really?
Yeah, it was a bad relationship that had sort of happened and it sort of transpired on the show. And I was very open about it, like something I wouldn't necessarily ever do again, but I was very open on it on the show and it just felt sort of therapeutic. And it's funny when people come and they say they're like, oh, I just started listening. I'm going to go back to the beginning and listen through everything. I always tell them like, just so you know, I'm okay. Like it all worked out. It's okay. Like, cause there's going to be a year or two that's just, oof.
It's rough. There's that long tail and we forget about it. Like it happens a lot on SGU. And I think it's probably just a numbers game, right? With Talk Nerdy, like I love the show and I love my audience. And I've been doing this now for over 4 years and you guys are amazing. That said, SGU is way older. It's been around much longer and it's like orders of magnitude more listenership, right? It's a way bigger
show.
There's
a gold standard. Yeah, that's
right. Yeah. And so it's crazy when we get emails that are like, I've just started listening, right? Yeah. Because they're in the Perry years. They're definitely, I haven't joined. Right. They're coming up on Rebecca. These are all big changes. And so it's so funny to think that there is this long tail and they are listening to an era that doesn't exist anymore.
We're so far past it. Frozen time chunk. But the beauty of podcasting is that it's so intimate. You're in the person's head that's listening. And, you know, we are 3 inches away from our microphones. And that's what it feels like on some level of like these people or this person is in your head. And what they are experiencing is real time and is happening in the moment because that's what was happening in the moment. So it's a real lovely and terrifying at the same time slice that people get sort of exposed to. I love it when someone walks up to me and they'll reference something. You know, someone at Nexus will walk up and they'll say, pancakes. And I'm like, okay. You know, yeah, show 2:15, you know, you did a 15 minute bit about pancakes. And I'll be like, oh yeah, I'm sorry. That was 7 years ago on a Wednesday. I talked for 15 minutes about pancakes, you know, but to them, I just told them that. I just told them that.
So weird. You
know, it's weird, but awesome and weird. Yeah.
It does happen. Like I'll get tweets or emails and I have to be like, I'm so sorry. Can you like give me a little more context?
Yeah, just a touch of context. Yeah. Because very often it's just, you're wrong about the color red. I'm like, what? I'm sorry. Yeah. Like, please, could you? Yeah.
And more often than not, when they do give you the content and you remember, you're like, oh yeah, I was totes wrong.
I completely forgot.
But yeah, for sure. Like I got so many messages the other week on SGU. I was talking about PET, which is PET plastic stands for? See, I can't even remember now.
Polyethylene, whatever.
Polyethylene terephthalate, but it's PHTH. And so I kept calling it terephthalate. And at least five people were like, you don't pronounce the P. I was like, yeah, okay, thank you. Yes. You're right.
Wait, are you saying the SGU audience is somewhat pedantic in terms of their
And the funny thing is we have this ongoing inside joke where we use the word pendantic. I wasn't even there when it was first.
Great. That's right.
And so I'll say it all the time. I'll be like, guys, not to be pedantic. And one time I got an email where somebody was like, not to be pedantic, but Kara keeps mispronouncing.
Oh, that's awesome. I love the double play around, you know, the caduceus eating its own tail or whatever that is.
Oh,
you
know, my gosh,
like, the joke is the joke.
It's like, come on, guys, this is very meta, right?
I love that kind of stuff. Yeah.
So let's talk about the Geologic podcast. Geo, because your name is George and people call you Geo.
The only podcast. People, it's funny that
really
that was never
I've
my
never
name.
Called you Gio.
Yeah, that was never my name, like growing up or anything. And I already had a, you know, I'm Ukrainian by culture and by I'm first generation Ukrainian American, so I spoke Ukrainian at home. Still speak Ukrainian with my parents and stuff. And so my like Ukrainian name was Yuki. So like
Yuki
yeah. So it's a sort of a shortened version of Yuri, which is like George. You know, it's the Ukrainian version of George's Yuri, but when I was a kid, I couldn't pronounce Yuri. I would say Yurki, which became Yuki, which is also short for Ukrainian. So kind of it's perfect. So everybody called me Yuki. Like everybody called me my grandparents, my parents, my teachers, Ukrainian teachers, my scouting troop. Everybody called me Yuki in the Ukrainian part of my life. And in the American part of my life, I was George. There was a weird crossover because I had my dad as a coach for baseball and swimming and soccer, and he would call me Yuki in practices. So people that were on those teams then started calling me Yuki, which was like this weird, like some Ukrainians, some school people, some Americans, whatever. And then I started the podcast thing with this Geologic idea, which was originally a name of just a performance ensemble that I had. It was the Geologic Orchestra. I thought, that's kind of clever and funny.
Because it's George rock. Meets Logic.
George meets Logic. And at the time, it was like, oh, it's a rock orchestra. So, like, we're playing rock music, Geologic. It seemed to be really funny.
Rock. I get it. I was like, where are you going with this? Like, Prague? Like, is it Prague? No, like actual like physical rocks. I get it. So, I love it. That's great.
It was funny for 2 minutes. But yeah, funny. Exactly. But then, you know, I sort of started signing emails, Geo, and the Geo thing started. And then I think one of the first times I was on the SGU, they all called me sort of Geo. And then that was it. So now I have like the podcast version of me is Geo, the Ukrainian version of me is Yuki, and then the American version is George. So it's...
I'm going to admit I didn't even understand it until like just now because I mean, I get it because your podcast, I don't know, it took me a minute because I was like, Geo is not how you pronounce George.
Right.
And you don't, you know, until you like write somebody's name a lot, when you're just only addressing them verbally, you just don't see it. You're like, oh yeah, your name's George. Yeah. Like Geo is not George, but of course it's George. Yeah. That's how you spell George.
My favorite thing though, is that on iTunes, on one of the reviews, there was a person who said like, I listened to 3 episodes and no mention of geology, like disappointed, like, you know, garbage, like, you know, 1 star. But it took you like 3 hours to figure out that, you know, there's no geology in the program. And then conversely, geologists have tuned in and expecting it to be a show about geology and then loving what they heard and became fans. And like, they will write to me like about once a year, a geologist will write to me and say, yeah, I totally started listening to this thinking it would be about rocks and it's not. And I dig it. It's just silly and fun. And I dig it. That's my
favorite. That is so funny. Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about what you do on the show because it's just you and sometimes your mom.
Yes. Yeah.
So is it like the musings of the day? Does it vary like the amount of effort that you put into like planning what you're going to do? Are there times when you're just so swamped that you're like, I'm going to turn on my microphone and hope that words come out of my mouth?
Well, I've gotten to the point where I can do a show. And what's lovely is over the years, I get a lot of help from my listeners. They send me in ideas for these sort of preconceived bits. So there's sort of 3 aspects of the show. There's like my life as a working musician. Mm-hmm. There's my sort of love of science and the relationship of me emceeing conventions and the skepticism, that kind of stuff. And then just silliness. Like those are the 3 things. So I'll talk about what it's like to be, you know, driving in a car at 2 a.m. or just like this past week, I talked about having to take a tambourine away from a video guy, you know, who was playing at a wedding. It was just like, do you please go do your job and we'll do our job and fine.
Also like now there's like a tambourine track to every video. Good job, dude.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Exactly. And then, you know, the skepticism stuff. So we have like bits. So there's a thing called interesting fauna, which is just like weird animals that I just find and think are interesting or weird or bizarre animal behavior. I talk about that. We have the religious moron of the week, which is someone being kind of really stupid in the name of religion. Those are sent in to me by listeners and sometimes I'll hunt for them myself, but there is never a shortage of those. Like I said, we have Gio's mom reads Jay-Z lyrics or she calls in, we do the thing, we chat for a little bit.
Can I say, I'm so glad you picked Jay-Z and not Kanye because hello.
Oh, hello.
Can we just take a second?
Talk about the thing of like getting self-absorbed and not understanding how like the universe actually works after a while because everyone says you're a genius. Like,
oh my gosh. Like this slavery thing that he's been getting into. This like TMZ reporter who totally schooled him, which like, why would I ever be aware of that except that Apple News told me about it.
No, I watched that footage of like, what you didn't see. And I'm like, all right, well, let's see it. And it was... to that guy's credit of just being like, look, I love you. Like,
I know.
You've been my hero for the last 10 years and you are embarrassing yourself and everyone involved by siding with these awful people that want to basically do us harm or just don't care. It was great. Yeah, it was
so crazy.
It was because awful like that, the whole thing was.
Yeah, your bit would have taken like a really dark turn.
Oh, forget about it. Yeah.
So, but go Jay-Z.
Yay.
And I saw some meme somewhere that was like the power of the wife in the relationship or something. It's like showing the two of them.
Seriously. Seriously.
Rough. Anyway.
Did you see some of that Beyonce footage from Coachella?
Yes.
Oh my God.
Queen Bee.
Seriously. I mean, now like it's very easy and very popular, you know, amongst, you know, like, look, I'm a, you know, mid-40s musician, you know, and there's this kind of thing of like what's real music and what's not. And it's very easy.
Of course. Is pop real music?
Yeah, you know, like if it's not jazz, it's this or it's not that. It's not. And it's like, and I years ago was just like, no, this stuff is awesome. Like, you know, Beyonce is amazing. Like,
Sorry,
Lady Gaga is amazing. Like,
yeah, even Katy Perry, I think is amazing. Like, if you've ever been to a live show, which like, you know, it's not my jam. Like Katy Perry is not my choice of like what I listen to in the car. But a friend of mine had a little girl they had tickets to see Katy Perry, and then their other little girl had to have surgery, and so they had to tell their girl they couldn't take her, and she was really sad. Yeah. Yeah, it was like a whole thing. And so me and a friend who's about my age offered to take this like 9-year-old or 11-year-old, I can't remember at the time, to the Katy Perry concert. Mm-hmm. And it was a whole thing. And we were like, okay, this should be interesting. And we went, and I was blown away, not just by the musicianship, but by the stage.
Oh, yeah, forget about
like,
that.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, these are performers.
Totally, yeah.
This is not an easy job.
Anyone that has reached that level of success, like, has worked their tails off. Like, I don't care if you like the music. I don't care if you appreciate it, if it's sophomoric, if it's simple, if it's whatever. Like, just from the sheer aspect of effort, and no one falls into those levels of success by accident or by coasting. You know, at least they don't stay there. Maybe they'll pop in there for a minute or two because of a trend or because of some weird synchronicity.
Yeah, but they don't have staying power. They're not the ones who are, because also the music industry has changed a lot in recent years. I used to date a musician who kind of like was quite successful and, you know, would tell me about the way that things worked. And he used to always say that, like, Katy in many ways was one of the last of the era of musicians where you could really make like stupid money. Like at a certain point, the industry shifted so that it really was not, I guess, preferential to the artist.
Oh, well, it's never been really preferential to the artist. It's the preference towards the artist has always been incidental. It's always been secondary, and you could be very successful, but it was almost sort of by accident because the success of the labels and the success of the money people was so gigantic that, oh, okay, to them, it was throwing crumbs to an artist.
No. Isn't that insane?
It's insane. It's insane.
Like, people don't realize that you have to pay for your studio time, and it's a lot of money. Like, you have to pay so much money to get a record made that, like, unless you're at a Katy Perry level, like, you're actually not cleaning up.
No. And it's, you know, that's why you sell t-shirts, and that's why you sell stuff that, you know, Eve is, you know, people will be totally fine to give you $5 for a sticker, but they won't pay $10 for, you know, something that cost you $30,000 to be, you know, conservatively,
you know. They'll give you $5 for a sticker that's going to fall apart on their laptop within a year. But like, the music's going to last their lifetime.
Absolutely.
And they won't pay for it. Yeah. They'll like rip it off online.
I mean, people will pay $500 for a Rolling Stones ticket, but they will not pay $11.99 for the latest Rolling Stones CD. I still don't understand the dichotomy. I still don't understand it. It's so strange. It's so.
You're so right.
And $8 for a hot dog at the concert. They will throw $8.50 down for a hot dog and $7.50 or $12.50 for a beer. But
they should just make it so the hot dogs are $12 and you get a free CD.
Seriously. Well, that's what Prince did. You know, years ago, Prince had this thing of like, it was every concert ticket got a CD. And then that counted towards
record sales. That's smart. You
know? And so he had a number one album all of a sudden. It was like, boom, out of nowhere. This is about 10 years ago or maybe even more. All of a sudden, Prince had a number one album. And it's like, wait, what? And then Billboard said, all right, can't do that.
No, that's not fair. Because like, the industry is changing and people have to get creative because none of us have CD players anymore. We all are listening to digital files and a lot of people don't want to pay for them.
Yeah.
It's a huge bummer
thing. And it's what amazes me. The best example of the sort of the unfairness of the whole record thing was like, let's say you got signed, like the dream of every independent person, like musician, like you get a record contract. Okay. So you go and you record your first album. Now you think like, oh, the record company's paying for this album to be recorded and produced and everything. No, they are, you are paying for it. It's just you pay for it later. So it's in essence like a mortgage on your house. It's a mortgage on your recording career. So
yeah, it's like you get signed and they're like, you better make us some money.
Exactly. Now, the craziest thing is that once you've paid that money back, once you like, let's say you are the one in a million and you pay the money back and your album actually is successful and you've paid for the studio time and the videos and all of the limousines and all of the helicopters and all that kind of stuff, the record label still owns the master recording. So it's like you buying a house, you pay the bank 30 years. And at the end of it, the bank's like, well, this is our house. And if we want to split it up and put it on a compilation of greatest house hits, we can do that. It's insane.
It's insane. And then if you fulfill, you know, you're able to make enough money to pay them back, is there a rev share of more sales or is that all yours once you fulfilled what you owe
your
them?
Deal. It depends on your deal. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Sometimes people have gotten screwed, but they're just getting, in essence, sort of money up front for the next project, you know? And then they say, well, that's why you tour. You can, you know, you can keep your ticket sales, you know, or whatever. Like, but even that is
weird, your merch
too.
Sales. It's, but yeah, sometimes the record label owns a portion of the merchandising, sure. Right? Absolutely. It all depends on how crap, and the deals are getting crappier and crappier. Like, that's really like, it's just at a point now where these big, you might think of a really big star who came up within the last like 3, 4, 5 years, like a Cardi B or something like that. Like, she's probably not doing that well, like financially. I mean, better than like us.
Sure, well, sure. But what's funny
in
is
the grand scheme of things,
there is a certain savvy now amongst artists that are coming up. So you take someone like, what was the guy's name?
Macklemore,
exactly.
Yeah, you know, he did it all himself.
He did it all himself. He was literally smart. Like printing stuff in his house, mm-hmm. You know, and he had a top, whatever it was, 15 album or whatever it was. So when labels came to him, he had the sort of comfort to say, no, what are you giving me?
Like, yeah, he's like, I don't need this deal. I can do it on my own.
Kid Rock was a similar thing. He was huge, you know, for whatever you think about Kid Rock, but he was huge in Detroit. And he was basically saying like, I will make more money on each individual record sale if I sell 50,000 albums than if I sell 4 million for you. So why would I want to do that? I have my audience and I will make $9 out of $10 as opposed to making 50 cents on every album, you know, so they get good deals. Dave Matthews was a similar thing, you know, very well established in their sort of smaller circles where they were able to say, what can you give me? That unfortunately,
and here we're talking about thousands, I'm sorry, like millions, maybe even tens of millions of dollars. But a good parallel would be how we podcast in the hundreds to maybe thousands of dollars range, which is that, you know, you can be in a podcast network and some people do and they do really well. And what they get out of it with the cross promotion is worth it to them. But I've always maintained, both with Talk Nerdy and I think Skeptic's Guide has always had the same mentality, even before I joined, that like, I want to do it myself because I want to make sure that I maintain some control over it.
That's the thing. And my dad always talks about that, where like he says to me, you know, if there's ever, you know, whatever financial worries or whatever or concerns or opportunities, even, he's always just like, remember that you are doing exactly what you want to do.
Yeah.
And there is a monstrous value in that. You know, he loved when Dave Chappelle walked away from $50 million.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because Chappelle realized like, oh, this is not what I wanted to be doing. This has not become the thing that I thought it was going to be. People are misinterpreting what I'm doing. And so I'm going to walk away. And people would say, how could you do that?
He had to prioritize his mental health. I always say that too. That's my number one.
Totally.
First comes like, it's like food, water, shelter, love, mental health.
Absolutely.
Like all those things come before any other decisions.
Yeah. And it's, you know, if I put out an album, that album is going to be exactly what I want it to be. Like, you know, I tell this to people that are starting too, you know, younger people or whatever that are recording or whatever, that are sort of concerned about what should they do. And I say, like, odds are your creative output will not be successful in the traditional sense of making money. Like that's just, that's statistics. So at the very least, it should be successful in terms of what your vision was.
For sure. Like, can you imagine giving up your vision and making no money?
Exactly.
How sad.
That's the worst case scenario of just like, oh, I've commodified and I've made all these concessions and I've conceded. And then it's a failure. And then what do you have? You have nothing.
No, that's a huge bummer. And the truth is, even if you have a modicum of success, financial success, it gets to the point where you have to start weighing between like, do I do all the work myself? Do I farm some of it out? How much is it worth it for me to like pay an editor, for me to get an assistant? Sure. Like even let's say with the SGU book, you know, I think it was really hard at the beginning for Steve because he's so used to being in ultimate control that when we got an offer for a book, he's like, hey, we got an offer for a book, let's do it. And it's like, we should probably get an agent. You know? And yes, I know they're going to take a big cut, but like in the grand scheme of things, they're going to help us make more money because this is, you know, what they do for a living.
Totally.
But it's hard when you've been the one holding onto the reins for so long to like learn sort of where to give up a little bit of control and where to maintain critical control. Yeah. It's, I think that is a very sophisticated decision that everybody has to make in their life.
Sure.
Everybody.
I'm a big believer in the collaborative effort too.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's hard sometimes for people that have a singular vision to sort of admit that sometimes. And it's like the George Lucas syndrome, just to get nerdy for a second. I mean, you look at, you look at the first Star Wars, and it was such a collaborative effort in terms of producers and engineers and his writing and all the actors and everything.
It had to be, right? Because they were inventing the special effects.
Exactly. You know, and it was just like the first cut was horrible. And it's like, what do we do? Mm-hmm. And then he went to his director friends and said, hey, Coppola, what do you think? And he was like, well, the third act is garbage. You got to get rid of it. Blah, blah. Collaborative. And then, you know, as Lucas becomes more and more independent, quote unquote, or just he is the yes man because his name is at the bottom of the production ultimately. And no one's going to start questioning his motivations his decisions.
He has a hit. People surround him and go, you're amazing. You're a genius.
That's the thing. It turns to shit. It slowly just turns to crap. And it's just like, it's very difficult to have a single, there are examples. There are plenty of examples of people that can have sort of a singular solitary vision and make it carry through. But I think even in those examples, there's always collaborative people. I mean, I'm a gigantic Frank Zappa fan. That's like one of my biggest influences. And I love Frank and he's awesome. But Frank was always at his best when he had the most interesting and most talented players in his band. Because it wasn't just the singular, like when he had just himself working in a studio, things were great, but they would get very weird sometimes. They would get very sort of out and like Frank is being really Frank. You know, it's like 98% Frank. Frank was, to me, was always best when it was like 60% Frank and then 40% whoever else.
Yeah, because like a true artist is probably making art for themselves, and a commercial artist understands that they should make money off of their art.
Sure.
And it's really about finding that balance. Like as a musician, sure, there's like my boyfriend is really into super obscure music and he randomly likes a lot of weird, you know, weird stuff. Yeah. And I'll be like, wow, this hurts my brain when you play this record. And he's like, yeah, it's like not for everybody. And I'm like, yeah, they've probably sold three of these albums. Sure. And it's like, yeah, this is not a commercially successful band. And
look, there's a value in that. There's an absolute value in that to sort of have this obscurity be your shield of honor, you know?
Uh-huh.
I think, look, some of the most, for me personally, some of the most brilliant music ever was the Beatles, and it's some of the most commercially successful music ever. So it's, I don't think there's a mutual exclusive nature between success and interest and whatever. And like you said, it's a balance. It's finding that equation that works best and that you can challenge your listeners, but not necessarily berate your listeners or berate your consumers. It's a fine balance.
Absolutely. Like there are things I'm not willing to give up on Talk Nerdy. I'm sure there were things you're not willing to give up on Geologic. Sure. There are things that, you know, Steve and the gang are not willing to give up on SGU. Like we are very specific about our advertisers on SGU. On Talk Nerdy, when I used to be with a big advertising firm and my numbers weren't where they wanted them to be, and they would tell me like, you should get your numbers up. And I would be like, well, how do you recommend I do that? And they would say, you need to book celebrities. And I was like, but I interview smart people on my show.
Right.
Like, I'm not saying there aren't any smart celebrities, but I'm not going to just book celebrities for the sake of booking celebrities. Yeah. I don't care enough about my numbers to do that.
Totally. Yeah. There's a freedom in that. And it's hard to put a price on that of being able to like, I'm going to book the guests I want. I'm going to talk about the stuff I want. I'm going to be obscure sometimes. I'm going to be totally non-obscure sometimes, but it's my selection. And that's, you know, it's really valuable.
It's really valuable, but it's also a big challenge. And I'm sure you face this as well. Like what we do, both of us, even though we do very different things, what we do is very niche, or you may say niche. both are correct, by the way, if you live in America.
Yes, they are. Very good.
But it can be difficult because in some ways, when you maintain a niche, you're like the guy. Like you'll get hired. It's like, of course, we want George. Or like I might be doing a TV show and it's like, oh, Kara's the one because she's the only one who really does it. But at the same time, there's not always work.
Sure.
And so there's this constant struggle of like, do I make myself more broad? Do I work to be more general? Do I want to be working more on X, Y, and Z? Or do I just really want to focus my attention here, knowing that like, I'm probably not going to make as much money as I could if I spread my wings a little bit more? Like, how do you handle that with the sort of, I mean, I'm interested, like, who knows if anybody listening is getting anything out of this, but I'm interested for my own edification as a freelancer, because the freelance lifestyle is a very particular lifestyle that you and I have both embraced.
Yeah.
And you've been doing it a lot longer than I have.
Well, you know, look, to me, the thing I always strive for and appreciate is to be as appropriate as possible in whatever the circumstances are. Mm-hmm. So if someone has hired me to be an MC for an event, I have to realize what my job is. My job is not about promoting me. My job is not about impressing people with my whatever guitar acumen. You can use those skills. Sure. My job is to introduce people and make the show run on time. Like that's the gig. And I have to be able to say like, okay, whatever I do has to fulfill that. If I'm playing drums at a wedding, my job is to make sure that people dance until they can't stand anymore so that they can say, God, that was the best party ever. And I do that by hopefully playing, you know, with a certain authority and accuracy in whatever genre we may be in at the time. So that if we're playing an ABBA tune, that's going to sound like ABBA. And when we're playing James Brown, it's going to sound like James Brown. Like that's my job. My job isn't to impress someone with my drum chops or with whatever. So for me, the creative things, like my job with the podcast, is to kind of be quirky and weird and not quite know what to expect, but yet it's kind of comfortable at the same time because there are bits that recur. But you might have a show where I am literally doing voices and just reading the transcript from an SGU episode, you know? and my listeners are going to be like, oh, okay, this is what he's doing. I mean,
I would die. You have to do an episode where you mix all of our voices up.
Where you're in. Yeah. I mean,
I make me Bob and make like Bob say everything I say.
Interesting.
It'd be so that weird, right?
Okay. That'd be neat. That'd
Can
be
you
neat.
Do a Kara accent? Gotta work
I
on
would
that.
Have to work on it. I have to work on it. Yeah. Get the. That's the thing is like, yeah, imitating women, I always worry. I don't want to offend
vocal
anybody.
Fry just right.
A little bit there. It's fine.
Yeah. It's.
I did an episode that was backwards once. Sort of inspired by the film Memento. Have you ever saw Memento?
Yeah, of course.
Wonderful movie. And I just did this episode where a lamp, you know, falls out of the ceiling, hits me on the head, and then the whole show's backwards. You know? And it didn't explain what was going on. And people loved that episode because it was just so weird, you know?
I love that.
I know that my audience kind of is prepared for that.
Oh, I was just going to say, the cool thing about podcasts is that you can kind of do it for you too, because it's not mainstream by definition.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like you're doing it for your audience and you're doing it for you. And the hope is, and at this point, you've been doing it for so long, I'm sure this is the case, that what you like is what the audience likes and vice versa.
Exactly. Yeah. And like I said, you get to sometimes challenge your audience a little bit. You know, people will, I get a lot of, I have a segment called Ask George, which is just questions. So mostly it's about music and fashion. For whatever reason.
Because you are like, so dapper.
Well, it's very nice of you to say.
You are so dapper.
My goal is to like make nerds look a little bit better in terms of their sartorial choices. That's like my ultimate goal. Like the spreading of science is great, but like if I can teach nerds how to do a Windsor knot and make it look okay like that, oh, that would be lovely.
Well,
like,
or just teach them the word sartorial, by the way.
Right, yeah. how to buy pants that fit. Like that would be lovely, you know. But so that's my quest. Anyway, but I get to challenge the audience sometimes where someone will say, like, you know, going back to our previous topic, oh, I hate Britney Spears, or I hate, you know, and I'll be like, look, the song Toxic is genius.
The song Toxic, I'm so glad you said that. It's like one of my favorite pop songs. And I don't really like Britney Spears, but that is my go-to karaoke jam.
Oh, hello. Right? I mean,
amazing
workout song. And then, so like you need to, and to my listeners' credit, they'll be able to say, I never thought about it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I trust you in these other things and blah, blah, blah. And so, yeah, it's a cool way to think of it. So, and then subsequently, you know, if I'm a guest on the SGU, I know that my job there is to sort of be the fun semi-outsider who might, you know, ask the guys a certain question or two or whatever. Whereas it's not an opportunity for me to be experimental backwards podcasting guy, you know?
Oh yeah, because the SGU is so, same with me, like the SGU is so like formulaic. I mean, that's what people like about it, right? It has a format. And so sometimes we go off book and sometimes Steve is like, you know, none of that's making it.
Right, totally. Yeah.
Like, ah, damn it. Yeah. But that's why I like to do interview shows for me personally, right? Is because I get to like dig deep into one person's process, into one person's content. And really, I think also it's low hanging fruit for me. Like, I don't feel like I'm ever putting my guests on the spot because I'm like, it's so funny. There are people who just don't get it. And they'll be like, okay, can you send me the questions in advance? Or like, what do I need to prep? Like, how? And I'm like, no, you don't understand. You don't have to prep anything.
Yeah, we're just talking.
Like, just show up. It's like the easiest job ever.
Yeah. No, I love
that.
A real conversation can happen. And, you know, real conversations, especially among people that have expertise in something. Like to me, I love the spreading of expertise, but sometimes the more interesting thing is the secondary stuff. Like the questions I ask you guys on the SGU of like, you know, what's the thing that you feel is overrated about you?
Or that's everybody's favorite premium content episode.
Oh my God.
I think it's premium
so much
content.
Fun. Yeah.
Like all of our patrons and people on the old system that are, I guess, members of the SGU were like, what? This is like, this is the first time I ever really got to know Steve. He plays it kind of close to the vest. And so people don't feel like they know him that well. And so they were like, oh my gosh, like I really learned so much about you guys. Yeah.
But like, you know, if I had Steven Pinker on the show, I don't think I would talk about language. I would talk about like, what's the last movie you saw? Or like, what, you know, like, how do you drink your coffee? Like, what's your process in the morning to make coffee? Because I want to know what Steven Pinker is doing when he's making, like, to me, that's fascinating. Like,
I'm hoping to have him on the show soon. I've been talking to his publicist. And so, of course, it's like they're on to promote their new book. So then you talk about the book. And then anytime they say or do anything that reminds you of some tangential thing, that's what I do. And sometimes I get, like, in my iTunes ratings, people will be like, oh, she talks too much about like rando friendship stuff. And like, I really just want to learn about it. And I'm like, whatever, sorry, that's my show. Like, go listen to the 10,000 other episodes that he did for other radio.
Go read the guy's book. If you want the info about the person, go read their book. Go see her movie. Go whatever it may be. Like, I want to know, like, you know, do they put their shoes on first or their socks? You know, like,
order? You ask that. Like, I was actually really disappointed the last time that you hosted. Maybe it was Nexus. What was the last time we were together at a conference?
Was it Nexus? Well, were you at the, what's it called?
CSICon?
CSICon.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I was
definitely there. Okay. So the last time that you introed us, as you were talking about your job as a host, when you're doing emceeing, is to A, make people look good and intro them, and B, keep to time. So obviously we're probably behind when you introed us because you didn't get to intro us with all that info.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, I'm sure you've introed the guys with that info a million times, but you never asked me those questions. And when I was told that those were the questions that you asked, I was like, what? Doesn't everybody answer these the same way? So, okay, tell everybody who's listening right now how you often introduce people at shows.
Well, yeah, I like the sort of, again, to go on to the inside a little bit because the thing that always annoys me if I see an MC do is like everybody gets a program, right? So you're at this conference and you get the little program book.
And the
introduction person reads the thing that you're holding in your hand. And it's like, why are you like, I'm totally, or I could go online and find out the details. So I go very general details, like maybe this is the latest book they have. This is what they're known for.
Or like this is
and
a professor.
Yeah, this is a professor, whatever, who's known for Bapa and they are the associate blah, blah, blah. And then I have, okay, what was the first piece of music that you bought with your own money when you were a kid?
What was yours?
That's a question. From In 3D by Weird Al Yankovic. That was the first album I bought at a Woolworths with my very own money.
And how old were you?
I think I was 11.
Adorable. Well, that shows that we grew up in slightly different eras because the first album I ever bought was a single of Regulators by Nate Dogg and Warren G.
Oh my gosh, nice. Okay, yes,
with my own money.
Different.
In my three disc changer. By the time I had a CD player, three disc changers existed.
Sweet. Yes. Sweet. Nice.
Okay.
So there's that. Mm-hmm. There is, do you prefer cake or pie?
Oh, that's a hard one.
I think I prefer
a moussey kind of a pie, like a chocolatey or French silk kind of a pie, but I don't really eat the pie crust. No, I prefer cake. I'm a cake person. Okay. What about
you? I'm a cake person too. Yeah, give me like a good carrot cake and that's a good weekend.
Cake. I don't want vegetables in my cake. That's some crap.
Oh no. Oh dude, it's a well done carrot cake. A bad carrot cake is like torture, but a good carrot cake.
Layers of like frosting and like I want the chocolate with like the fudgy shit in there.
Okay.
I got you.
Okay. And again, these are not, you know, these questions vary from thing to thing. I always try to come up with new ones. Mm-hmm. Who would win in a fight? Ninjas or pirates?
Oh, that's a hard one. Actually, I think I had to debate Bob. It was zombies and something else at an extravaganza 1 year.
I feel like I
might have won too. And that was hard because that was a bit of a trial by fire. Like I hadn't been around that long. That's a hard one. I'm going to take a pass on that. What about you?
Okay. I would think ninjas because I think, you know, you have this certain rum infusion with pirates.
Yeah.
So I think
and
there's
got,
a
like,
little
the
bit more discipline.
Legs.
That's what I mean.
And
you know?
A parrot on the shoulder.
Yeah. You know, you're going to be a little bit more inhibited.
One eye.
Like, yeah. It's like, what are you doing?
Ninjas are stealthy. I feel you.
Oh, so there's this. So what is your process in terms of getting dressed? Is it sock, shoe, shoe, lace, lace? Is it sock, shoe, sock, shoe? Is it sock, shoe, lace? What is the variance there as
Who
you're getting dressed?
Does sock, shoe, lace, sock, shoe, lace? That is crazy pants.
People do it.
No, they People don't. Do That's insane. Like when you learn that about somebody, are you like, who are
Seriously?
You?
Seriously. It totally changes how you look at them and like whether they're included in your will or not. Yeah, completely.
That is nuts. I mean, I've got to say I'm almost exclusively sock, shoe, shoe, lace, lace, okay. or I'm sock, shoe, lace, shoe, lace. I'm probably sock, shoe, lace, shoe, lace. I think that's right. But as a general rule, I prefer shoes that don't have laces.
Okay.
I also have bought, they make these amazing laces now that are elastic with these clips on the end. So you can do the cool, you know how you can lace up your shoe? So it's just the bars across and you don't have to see all the crisscrosses. And then they're tucked in. So it makes all shoes into slip-ons.
There you go. Nice. Yeah. So it's those kinds of questions. They're fun. And I think in many ways, they reveal a little bit more than just reading someone's CV.
Oh, for sure.
To get to know that, you know. Whatever.
What is your shoe Richard situation?
My shoe is sock, shoe, shoe, lace. Sometimes if it's like a jogging shoe, if I'm going to go exercise, usually then it's sock, shoe, or sneaker,
lace. Yeah, I'm with you. I'm there with you. That makes plenty of sense to me. What about you ask guys about their under things?
No, that's too hack.
That's too hack. People, what about, I guess you can't ask girls about their under things because then that's like,
I wouldn't do that. Okay.
You got to be appropriate and that's like never appropriate.
And your favorite ice cream flavor, I think reveals more than whether or not you have,
boxes panties or boxers. Yeah, exactly. Or whatever. What's your favorite ice cream flavor?
You know, there is something still to this day about Ben and Jerry's fish food.
Oh, that's the one I get when they have a frozen yogurt version. That's the one I get when there's no other option. Not that it's not my favorite, but when there's like 10 things, like that's the one I'll get.
Yeah, there is something, the yogurt version has a little bit more tang to it, which I actually enjoy.
Good, yeah.
That is the, when I've had like, you know, the 7 days in a row of whatever, and then this is the eighth day, and I'm just going to sit on the couch and watch Doctor Who. Have I like that? There's that. But a really good straightforward, you know, pure vanilla has a certain, like a real expensive vanilla. Yeah. There's a certain zen simplicity in that too. So it's sort of the either or. How about you?
I love it. So I'm definitely more of a caramel or like cinnamon person than like a chocolate person. And I also disagree with Bob wholeheartedly that, he loves peanut butter and chocolate, and I think peanut butter and chocolate is an abomination. So we have like fights about that, but friendly fights. My favorite ice cream in the entire world is McConnell's, which I don't know if you guys have that on the East Coast. Do you?
No.
Okay. It's Barbara ice cream company. Okay. It's in LA also, but I don't know how far it's spread. But McConnell's ice cream, they make a seasonal flavor called cardamom and ginger snaps.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. It's good.
I hear you. Yeah. Nice.
It's my flave.
We have a thing here. It's called the Bethlehem Dairy Store, and it's called the Cup is the name of the thing. It's one of these places that has been here since literally 1930, I think.
Awesome.
And like nothing has changed about it. Like they might have like there's a stereo in the place. Like, that's like the one, like they put speakers up in 1970. That's about the only thing, you know. And they do a soft serve in a cone with chocolate sprinkles. Again, simple, but just the pure dairiness of it that just it's like a little party for your tongue that just like you don't want to invite anyone else to. It's wonderful. Yeah, there's that. They also do this amazing, they'll do like frozen root beer and then layered with the vanilla, and you just in the summer when it's 90 degrees outside and you go to the Cup, you walk to the Cup, it's about a mile away, so you feel good about yourself.
Walk. You earned it.
Walk. So it's totally fine. Yeah. And then you have a 1300 calorie dessert.
Anything else that day.
And that's it. Yeah. So that is a certain special, lovely place that's sort of hand dipped sprinkles poured on by a teen who's working there for the summer.
Yeah.
I think that all affects the flavor in a certain special way.
Absolutely. You know what you've done to me now? So generally, we're recording this on a Thursday. Generally, I record SGU on Wednesdays, this week Evan took his daughter to like the Warped Tour or something like that.
Oh, that's so right. Sweet. Yeah. She's like in the front row headbanging,
and
right?
So
yeah,
totally. I love it. And it's so cute hearing Evan talk about it because he's like, she's really into the metalcore music. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you sound like such an old man. Don't talk anymore. I love it. but I, of course, am not young. I'm 34 years old, and Evan's daughter is 16, 15, I don't know, but we totally listen that, to yeah, the same music.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah, we're like, so every time we hang out at conferences, I'm like, you're cool.
But she gets dressed up too. She like will dress as one of the band members. She does. Yeah, it's pretty great. Hardcore.
Yeah, and she has like green hair. She's totally badass. But we we're recording today because recording tonight. And if anybody, here's a little Easter egg. Here's me eating in the background. That's legit some like McConnell's ice cream that I'm about to order on Postmates.
See, that's how it gets inserted in the brain. It's funny. It's so crazy that I will be, you know, I will be in this mode of like healthy eating and I'm good. And I know tonight I'm going to have the good thing. I'm going to have the clean chicken and some rice and whatever. Mm-hmm. And then literally I will just see an ad in a magazine, you know, for Arby's. And it's like, I'm done. All right. I'm having that. Yeah. I'm having that. It's just that advertising genius, whatever glistening stuff they put on the meat to make it look like the deliciousness that, you know, it's not, but it's supposed to be. Oh my God, I'm so susceptible to that. It's so, but just like a hint of, even someone will say pizza in a conversation. I'm like, all right, that's it. I'm done.
But I appreciate that about you because like, I look at you and you look good. You're fit. You said you're in your mid 40s. You're definitely a fit person. You work out, you eat well, but you're not like so rigid about it that you can't enjoy your life. Like I live in LA and I have friends and I get it. They're actresses and it's part of their job and they're getting booked for certain jobs. And I feel bad for them because like they can't enjoy themselves ever. And I try, same thing. I see a trainer 3 times a week. I do cardio the other days, which sounds insane, but it's part of my schedule. I don't mind doing it. I enjoy it. But I do that so I can have pot pie for dinner.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. People think I'm a vegetarian like all the time. Like, are you a vegetarian? I'm like, no. And nothing against vegetarians. I just like, I enjoy a steak as much as I'll have a burger as much as anybody. I love these conferences actually because usually, you know, the deal is it's a 3-day thing. You don't sleep for 3 days. So by that third day, it's like, that's the day I'm going to go find this casino burger that's supposed to be famous, you know, like Vegas's best thing. And I'm just going to dive in and enjoy
it. I love it.
Because it's like I've earned it, quote unquote, you know, it's its own psychological weirdness. I know it's a whole thing of like rewarding with food is like the worst thing you can do, but too bad.
Too bad.
That's all I have.
Exactly. You know? We have to have some simple joys in life.
Seriously.
And I mean, Steve talks about this a lot and like, goodness, like he has lost so much weight and he looks amazing.
He's done so great.
Done so well.
Yeah.
It's all about balance. And you know what? That's He's it, the doctor, man. So I trust him.
Exactly.
It's all about moderation. Yeah,
it's funny how he's the guy that like I will check with sometimes to like, am I crazy? But I thought this. Like, what do you think? And I'll say, yeah, I think that too. And be like, okay,
yeah,
good.
Exactly.
All right, fine.
Yeah, it's like so many things are just in life are just about, you know, how about we maintain like some control, but also some indulgence. Like just find that balance and you'll be, you may not be the healthiest person in the world, but you'll sure be happy.
That's the thing. Like what else, then what are we doing this for? You know, like what are we doing all this stuff for on some level if you can't enjoy either a silly movie occasionally or some really sugary pop song or some sugary breakfast cereal occasionally? Like what are we doing this
I'm
for?
So with I you. Mean,
yeah, good. Good. And you know what? You eat that ice cream loud.
I will. And I'll talk all about it. And then we'll see who's co-listening to the shows.
Exactly.
So, George, I mean, we've got to talk. I've like kept you for way too long already, but we've got to talk about all the cool stuff that's like coming up in the future. There've got to be some conferences. It's May now. There've got to be some things that you know. I know sometimes we don't get booked for these things until closer to the events, but is there anything that's you know for a fact is on the books?
Well, Nexus is coming up in July. That's a wonderful, wonderful New York-based thing. You're going to be there. You're going to be there, right?
Oh, yeah, I'll be there.
Okay. Yes, you obviously were all going to be there. That's, I think, like the 9th or 10th one that they've done of those, which is a great...
That's nuts.
I love the vibe of Nexus.
Yeah.
It's got this urban New York...
Yeah, it's like an FIT usually. It's like right in this like cool fashion district. This will be, I think, my third Nexus. That's cool.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So that's coming up... In the fall, we're going over to across the pond, over to QED, which I am so excited for.
It's so fun.
I emceed the very first one that they had, whatever, five
really?
Years ago. And it was
okay, so I did QED, I think, just last year. Was it the year before? It might have been the year before. Gosh, I'm so bad with my chronology. But I did QED somewhat recently, and it was so much fun. Yeah. And I have to admit, like, as much as I love my American skeptic community, I really like the British skeptic community.
Oh, they're forget
so
about it. Warm. Just for the accents.
I know, just for the accents. Just for the accents. And just the vast quantity of beer these people can put down.
Oh my God.
And not even seem drunk. It's really impressive.
Yeah. There is a weird thing, you know, and again, I obviously American and I'm very proud of that. I'm for as much as I can be proud of that. Yeah, and the American audience has been wonderful. There is something though about the non-American audiences that there is almost this more appreciation because there's fewer options, I think. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, we went to Australia a couple mm-hmm. years ago and it was like, it was a Tuesday night and I did a solo show and like 100 people showed up. Like, I can't get 100 people to come to a solo show here in Bethlehem. Yeah. You know what I mean?
So yeah, we're like, just inundated with choices here, but you're
it's
right.
It's option paralysis. It's like, I can always go see you. I can always go see you. I can always go do that. And so you never do. Whereas over there, it's just like, oh, these people are in town, so let's go do
and
it.
And it's also, you know, like, it's, when you're in, I did Australia and New Zealand just this past year, like all their skeptic conventions yeah. and stuff. And there was something really warm about it's amazing. So, and also I think I was able to take the piss a little bit out of like what's going on in America in a way that like we bonded over that. Yeah, exactly.
Totally. Yeah. It's funny, I don't know if you remember this, but I wanted to do you remember we shared a limo about 5 years
Where?
Ago at one of the TAMs. I think it was your first TAM.
I was probably so overwhelmed. We did, like, we got picked up from the airport at the same time.
We both got picked up, and I didn't remember this until recently. And I was thinking, like, wait a minute, that was total, like, we didn't talk to each other. Like, we were both in this thing.
That was the first time I've ever done a skeptic or atheist or anything conference.
It might have been. It might have been. Yeah.
And it was TAM.
I don't know if you remember.
I don't think I do. I've got to start like racking my brain for this. Like, talk about being thrown to the wolves too. I met the SGU for the first time there. I know I met you there. I remember meeting you, but.
No, but so that was probably like we had just both landed.
How funny.
And I think I was at the cab, at the limo first, and because it's wonderful. They send you a car.
It's really like, nice. Was I nice to you? I hope I was nice to you.
You were totally nice. You were quiet. Yeah, you were very quiet and you were like, obviously in your own head.
I probably had my headphones on and was like half asleep.
Yeah, I think now I realize we were probably you know, overwhelmed because it's a thing. And I think we briefly spoke or something and you were probably on your phone.
I was really so shy and like nervous.
Well, you came across as like so incredibly cool, just like owning it. And I remember thinking like, okay, I'm a kid.
No, it's the lip ring. It's the lip ring. It's so great. You can be the shyest, dorkiest person, but you have like a few tattoos and a lip ring and people are like, oh yeah, look how aloof they are.
That's it, man. You had the dark glasses and I was just like, I can't even talk to this person, funny. But good for her. Good for her.
And I probably was traveling in pajamas like I always do. And you were probably wearing like a 3-piece suit.
Well, I always have a suit. I actually sleep in that too. So it's kind of like my pajamas. So yeah, it all works out. So
all your suits bespoke?
No, I mean, it's off the rack, but then you just get them tailored.
So that's, you do that's buy the key, off the rack. You know? Okay.
Oh my God. Yeah. H&M. H&M is like my
suits?
Candy
that makes
store.
You so happy.
Oh God. Yeah. H&M. And even like, you know, a blazer or two from, you know, Old Navy and stuff like that, which I know is not, you know, totally. You just got to get it. You just spend $15 and you get it tailored. And you know, that's the thing. It's just got to fit.
So
right.
Surprised. Okay. Do you have any designer suits? None.
No, I can't swing that stuff.
I would say if you were ever going to go designer, which again, I like that you actually go like budget suits and then make them your own. Yeah. I think that's amazing. But if you were going to go designer, it's a slightly less expensive designer, but I could see you looking amazing in it. It would be Ted Baker. If you're going to do any designer, do Ted Baker and maybe do like a Nordstrom Rack situation.
Yeah, I've done some Nordstrom sales stuff occasionally, so like I'll find that. But like I've literally bought suits at JCPenney.
That makes me so happy. I did,
and it's like you just get them fitted.
I did not know JCPenney still exists.
Yeah. No, you get like $100 suit.
This pleases me greatly. Oh my gosh, the secrets. I love the secrets. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm talking your ear off. I have to prep for SGU. You have a life that you need to go live. George, let everybody know, A, where they can find the podcast. B, we already said, come to Nexus, come to QED. Just Google such things and you will find them. Absolutely. So the podcast, the next time you're playing a gig, like tell us all the things.
Sure. GeologicPodcast.com is the thing. What's lovely about my name, which is my last name, Harab, H-R-A-B, it's unique enough that the first, I think, 110,000 things are me. So you can find everything if you just Google my name. PhillyFunk.com is the website for the band, the Philadelphia Funk Authority. If you're on the Northeast, we play all over Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Connecticut, up and down. We have we're having our 20th anniversary show at the end of May. May 25th is our 20th anniversary show right here in Bethlehem. We're bringing back alumni members over 20 years. It's going to be this gigantic extravaganza. We're really excited for that. Phillyfunk.com has all that info. Otherwise, just Google my name and check out the show occasionally. It's a bunch of silliness, but yeah. Hey, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Oh my God.
It's been a real
pleasure. Of course. And shit, I just realized, George, I didn't ask you my last two questions. And if I don't do this, I'm going to get like angry messages. So I hope, you've got like 3-4 minutes for me.
I do, absolutely.
Awesome.
All the time.
Okay, so I close every episode. Same two questions. Here they are. They're big picture. Get ready for this. We're going to dive deep. Yeah. Here we go. When you think about the future, I want you to think about the future in whatever context is relevant to you right now in this moment. It can be the future of your life, your career, your family, or it can be bigger, you know, America, the global kind of international issues that we're facing right now. When you think about the future, A, what is the thing that keeps you up the most at night? What are you like not feeling great about, you know, super, you know, kind of pessimistic and like, this is not a good thing. What do you really actually worry about? But on the flip side of that, what are you actually really hopeful for and optimistic? And it's not just lip service, like you're quite looking forward to.
Okay. The most sort of depressed that I think I have gotten recently has been the trend, a sort of downward trend in terms of political discourse and the bar being lower and lower and lower and lower. I used to think that a previous administration was like the worst administration possible.
Right?
And now you realize like, oh my gosh, I had no idea how bad an administration could be, which then makes me like your question posits, what will the next one be? Mm-hmm. Like where you can't even fathom like how much lower it could go in terms of everything.
Yeah, like
in terms
Alex of Jones for president or something.
That's what I mean. Or not even that. Like you know, like an Ottoman. Like, you know what I mean? Or like a scoop of vanilla with chocolate sprinkles. Like that will somehow, and then the defense of that scoop of ice cream will just like that worries me of the precedent gets set and it's very hard to go backwards sometimes with that. So that literally keeps me up. I mean, the first three nights after the election, I didn't sleep as did probably half of the United States. And I remember thinking like, I had never been affected in that way by anything ever.
Yeah.
And I didn't sleep for three nights. And I remember thinking like, oh, I guess like we just don't sleep now anymore. Like this is the way it is. And then slowly over the next week, I like got back into a schedule, but it was so the acceptance of it being like, oh, okay, this is what this is now. We just don't sleep, you know, and being like, okay, now things, obviously there wasn't a mushroom cloud the following week or whatever, but that really bothers me. The thing that I look forward to, or the thing that gives me hope on the opposite end of the spectrum, is the progress of humanity has been on a very defined course towards things getting better. And there is a, in the same way that you cannot fight a tide or a flood, you can maybe divert it, you can maybe channel it somewhat, try to, you know, build your summer house on that bay, but ultimately, you know, that tide will come in and will change your plan. So I think there has been this progression of advancement and progress that makes me think that what's happening now politically and socially, the stuff that's negative now, is the final, when the body is about to die, there's that final spasm, that sort of superhuman last final cough where grandpa sits up in the bed and just, and then they're done. And I'm hoping that that's where we are, is this final sort of like, hey, everybody, we're going to pick up this rock so you can see all the junk that's underneath it. And then we're going to disinfect.
Yeah.
And that gives me a little bit of hope. Seeing young people like 14, 15, 16 year olds being, for as cliched this term, but as woke as they are, is pretty damn inspiring. And it's like having this idea that when I hear someone spew awful racist stuff that part of me thinks, well, they're going to die soon.
Totally. They're just
soon,
a really sad, you know? Lonely person behind their keyboard. Yeah.
There's that too. But even that there is, you know, a certain vehemence from a 65 or a 70-year-old that just doesn't understand where we are. And it's like, okay, they just have to die. And then there's going to be a change. And that gives me hope, for as dark as that sentiment is of just like, we got to wait out the clock.
No, I'm so with you. I mean, there is a small, very vocal, but very small group of like young and active alt-right people who literally are totally bigoted and racist and misogynistic. But the truth of the matter is, even most young conservatives are so much more socially progressive than anybody, because the arrow of progress is in that direction. And the truth is, like, we want to be on the right side of history. There are certain people who just don't realize they're on the wrong side of history. But ultimately, you're right. Time will tell. And I don't think we're going to have a scoop of ice cream for our next president, because I do think that this administration has mobilized people. I got to hope so. Yes. Let's see what happens at the next election.
I hope so, too. You see... You know, and then at the same time, there are plenty of examples, you know, like Andrew Jackson was a horrible, horrible human being, like as horrible as you could be. And we got through that.
And now,
like,
we don't even remember that he did the things. We're like, who was he? Like the 20?
Exactly.
Like,
I don't know. Exactly. Right. Yeah. Hello. Let alone. Yeah. So there is that sort of, like, you know, what do they say? Every generation has it better than anyone has ever had it, and every generation thinks it's worse than it's ever been. You know, so there is that hopefulness overall. I just, that little discourse thing sort of bugs me a little bit, and the civility and the kind of the thing. But like you said, even some of the most sort of vile young people still will be like, oh no, my friend's gay, it's totally cool. You know, it's like, oh, okay, or I'm a vegetarian, or like, yeah, or no, I don't, you know, whatever. And it's like, yeah, or I think, whatever, censorship is bad. And I think a lot of that also has to do with just, look, when the hormones are a flying around, it's very easy to think all kinds of weird things, because you sublimate and you channel.
And you can also find people to support you. Like, you can find your echo chamber. You can find adults who should know better to support these ideas. So.
Yes. But I think a lot of that gets grown out, and you can't exist in the way the internet is. You can't exist with the access to different kinds of people. Like, you so have to limit who you are exposed to, which you can't do anymore. Like, to maintain those stereotypes, to maintain those tropes, to be able to have that sort of racist vision that you have. Like, you just can't do that anymore.
Yeah, I grew up in Texas. Like, you might live in a small, really rural town in Texas with, like, super racist grandparents. And, like, you know, it's a really segregated town. And you still get the day-to-day stuff. But the minute that you, like, go on YouTube, you're seeing people from all different races, all different religions, all different backgrounds. And, like, the exposure there is slowly but surely undoing all of that, tribalism. Yeah.
You know, music does it, comedy does it, popular media does it, because it's like, it just exposes you, and you go, like, you know, even if just the germ of your thinking can change, that's how it starts. And so, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, guys, words of wisdom from George Traub. I love it.
Oh, yes. Amen.
George, thank you again. This was so much fun.
Thank you very much. And good luck with everything. Please say hi to the guys. And
I will thank you. Absolutely. And everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.